Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
This is the Golf Under Par podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Jeremy McCullough. We are on a journey to find the information that's going to help you play the best golf of your life. Join us now as we dive in.
Welcome, everybody, to the Golf Under Par podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Jeremy McCullough, here with a special guest, Dr. Dan Coughlin, who's a strength coach, a physiotherapist, and has his PhD in specifically helping golfers in preparing, you know, for golf and physical training. So that we've got an excellent opportunity here to talk to somebody that knows and does this and studied this for years to help us learn and to grow. So Dan, thank you so much for being here and welcome to the show.
Yeah, no worries. Thanks for having me.
All right. So we were just talking, you don't golf. So I will forego my first question that I ask everybody, which is how'd you get into golf? But I guess we can talk a little bit about what kind of gets you into working with golfers then.
Yeah, totally. So it was an accident, as people have probably already gathered from the fact that I don't play the sport. I suppose for me, I wanted to work as a physio in sport. And I was sampling lots of different sports. So I was working in track and field, in cycling, in soccer, in all sorts of different things. And I set up a little clinic in a golf club, started seeing a few golfers. That happened to be like a regional center for England, the England program. So they had a job as for a physio, which I applied for, which is just like a part-time thing. And then I got that. And then actually quickly realized that by physio, they meant strength and conditioning coach, because they wanted me to do all the training stuff, and then realized I had to learn all that stuff and kind of slowly transitioned into more of a general physio, S&C, applied sports science, bit of everything type person. And that's kind of when I did my PhD. And then really the golf just kind of took off. I then got the England national job. So I lead their sports science and medicine service now. And then the European tour saw what I was doing with England golf. So then they asked me to set up a service for them, because they didn't have their medical service, but not strength and conditioning service. Obviously it was getting more popular. So then I set up the strength and conditioning service with the European tour. And now the ladies European tour have asked me to do the same with them. So I'm currently setting up a sports science and strength and conditioning service for those guys as well. So it's kind of escalated from having no interest in the sport at all to suddenly, like, yeah, working with, you know, all the kind of big names this end of the world.
Yeah, that's pretty crazy. So you obviously know your stuff for that being in those situations and being able to set those things up for these guys. You know, see a lot of the stuff that, like, I going through your social media, seeing a lot of the, you know, little tests and things that you're doing with some of the names out there. And so I wanted to chat with you about, you know, what are you looking at? What are you doing? So kind of a question, I guess, would be, you know, what most people should want to know is what transfers from the gym onto the course, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it's a really good question, and one we've thought about quite deeply, sort of at England and on the European tour, and of course just personally as well. And for me, I think there are a few key areas of transfer, and my experience in golf is that quite often the areas of transfer that are sold a kind of swing mechanics transfer, but I actually don't think that's the main priority, certainly from our sort of approach. So we sort of devised this thing called the probability of performance impact pyramid, which is just a fancy way of saying, like, rank the things that are most likely to impact the golfer and will affect most people most of the time. So if I had 100 golfers, what's the thing that's most likely to have impact? And then down to the more tricky things to have impact, which still you can impact, but they're just a bit harder. And so for us, at the bottom of that pyramid, i.e. the thing that we're most likely to have impact on, is availability. So making sure that players are healthy, injury-free, illness-free, and they can play for as long as they want to, both in terms of, like, have a busy week of golf, but also play from 2 to 102. The next thing is readiness. So what I mean by readiness is that we can make sure that players feel good when they turn up at the golf course, they're alert and they're prepared to play. And so for the tour players we work with, for example, that's like dealing with jet lag, dealing with the demands of being on the road and all that kind of thing. Up from that, we look at kind of different versions of movement. So, you know, you kind of got movement in terms of being able to move in a way which allows you to deal with the forces of the swing better, i.e. being robust. It kind of links into availability. Moving better or differently in terms of moving quicker so you can generate more club speed. And then sort of final thing that we think is the most difficult thing to impact is moving in a way which facilitates your kind of coaching direction at the moment, i.e. helps with centeredness of strike because we've changed the position at the top of your backswing or impact or something like that. So using training to change your movement pattern in the swing is probably the least likely area of impact. Although it's still possible, it's just hard. Whereas making you healthy, making you ready to perform and helping you hit the ball further is all kind of stuff that is bread and butter for us and much easier to impact most people most of the time, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So basically you're thinking of just tackling those low hanging fruits, right? Rather than, you know, your health and wellness versus, you know, specifically saying, oh, we're going to improve your ability to get into these positions through the training or the gym program aspect. So.
Yeah, 100%. And I think it's really important because quite often golf fitness is flipped on its head with that. It kind of sells the swing rather than selling the health and well-being benefits that the research just supports so strongly. And I think is so important for so many golfers. And also is kind of misquoted by commentators a lot, right? Like, oh, training is going to make you injured more. It's like, actually, the biggest reason that most tour players I work with train is to stay injury free and to perform better week on week.
Yeah, I've always enjoyed the stronger you are, the harder you are to kill, right? Like I've always enjoyed the phrase. So I kind of think of it that way of, you know, the stronger that we get, the more stuff we can handle, whether that's on the course or off the course. So just makes you that much better in all areas.
Yeah, 100%.
So curious as to, you know, you're setting up all these the sports science type stuff with all these different associations or companies, groups or whatever. So what are some of the things that you're specifically having them, you know, from assessment standpoint of looking at and tracking over the long term?
Yeah, good question. So we have a few different things that we do for assessment. I suppose assessment can be broken down into lots of different categories as well, right? Like you have your kind of typical performance assessment, which is how do I hit the ball further and or whatever. You then might have traditionally like a movement screen, which is identified to find things that might link into your golf swing, which we don't use so much, but you know, it's kind of a category to be aware of. I think you then have kind of robustness, specific robustness tests that you can do to look at likelihood of injury in people in general, knowing the kind of injury history of the sport or specific people who have specific injury histories that you want to kind of keep an eye on and monitor. Then you have your kind of monitoring in terms of like your day-to-day stuff that you might want to keep an eye on, which is kind of very player specific around maybe it's readiness, maybe again it's around injury, maybe it's around performance. So there's, and then you have obviously all the health stuff that you might look at, which could be outside of us, right? It could be like we have skin cancer screenings on tour that players come in for, or whatever other kind of health screenings that we have going on. So there's loads of levels to assessment. And I think most of the time in golf, people just think about like your TPI movement screen or something. Yeah. But actually, we have all these different layers going on all the time. What you'll find is that most of the layers outside of the performance testing are quite nuanced for us. Like we don't have a standard assessment process, we have like dependent on the individual. So if I start with like that kind of higher level performance side, we look at isometric mid thigh pull, which is for those who don't know, you stand on some force plates, you get yourself in the position like you're atop of a deadlift, so the bar is kind of in the middle of your thigh and you pull the bar up as hard and fast as you can. So you're pushing through the force plates really hard and the bar doesn't move. It's kind of fixed, so it doesn't move. And you do that for 5 seconds. And then from that, we can just see how much force you can produce, i.e. how strong you are. And we do it because it's a really low skill measure of strength that any player can do regardless of training history, and they can do in the middle of a tournament and they're fine. The other thing we look at is counter movement jump. So how high can you jump? We look at that on force plates and we calculate positive impulse from that. We don't look at jump height because if player puts on mass, then they get penalized. You know, so if you give them a training program for 6 weeks, 8 weeks, they start getting heavier, they don't jump as high. You think you're getting worse, but you're not. So instead, we look at impulse when they jump. And impulse is really predictive of club head speed in tour players. We've done some research on that. So we're pretty confident in what sort of changes equal what sort of distance. So there are like performance measures. From like a screening perspective, we don't screen at all, actually. We don't use any assessments, FMS, TPI, nothing like that. But what we do is look at the problem in front of us, i.e. we'll maybe watch a player warm up, watch a player train, just observe and kind of be aware of different movement patterns that they're comfortable with or not comfortable with. Then we'll have a conversation with them and their coach and see if they've got any specific issues they want us to look at. So for example, if their lead foot spins out when they're, you know, coming into impact, we might look at their hip range of movement. If they struggle with the top, you know, getting into the right position at the top of the backswing, we might look at thoracic rotation or whatever it is, but we do it on a kind of individual level rather than a standardized screen, just when called for. In terms of robustness measures as injury risk measures, neck pain and back pain are two of the most common injury sites in players. So fairly routinely, we do a maximal force test with the player's neck where they have to hold their neck in neutral and we try and pull them out of position. We use a force sensor to measure that just to see where their neck strength is, and also if they get injured, what we need to rehab them back to. And we also do something quite similar with the trunk where we try and pull them out of position, and with a force sensor we measure how much force we have to apply before they lose sort of neutral. And then that kind of helps us gauge their trunk strength, which could, you know, help with back pain, or at least, again, post rehab, what we're building them back up to. And then sometimes we'll do some specific ones like, you know, holding someone in like prone position in extension and seeing how long they can hold it for with a weight or whatever it might be. We'll look at some specific things, maybe like adductor strength or whatever. But at that level, it gets more like bespoke depending on the player's history. And then from like a medical screening perspective, I've already kind of mentioned, but we might do some wellness stuff from a monitoring perspective, but we have skin cancer screenings and we have doctors on site all the time who are helping with different things for different players. So kind of a long answer, but just trying to get across the nuance that's involved and the kind of beyond traditional screening sort of approach that we tend to use on tour and at England.
Yeah, so obviously the from a movement and physical standpoint, outside of, you know, your mid-thigh pull and like the impulse from the jump, it's all dependent upon those needs that you kind of see as you just go through some general movements. Is that?
Yeah, 100%. So like if I'm meeting a player for the first time, and we're talking about that kind of movement side, whereas some people might take them through a screening, what I'll tend to do is just say to them, oh, do a warm-up, and just put them on the spot and get them to do the warm-up that they normally do, and then see how they prepare. Like, oh, you're going to warm up for this iso pull. It's basically like you're getting ready for a max effort deadlift. Warm up how you would warm up in the gym. And then I'll just observe them warm up. If they've got a good warm-up routine, quite often you can see all the movement patterns that you want from that anyway. And if I see something of interest, I'll grab a little video of it so that we can use it as a reference point for the future. Or we can explore it more in later on in the session. If they look at me like, I don't know how to warm up, then I'll take them through a standard warm up, but then do the same thing. Once they know it, I'll get them to run through it a few times. I'll video bits that are worth monitoring in the future or investigating further. And then I'll speak to them and their coach about issues that they're having in the swing. And sometimes people just say, oh, I've not got any issues. I just want to get strong and robust and not get injured and hit the ball further, in which case that's fine. Or if they say, yeah, I've got this problem that I've really been struggling with, we think it might be physical, I'll look at that.
Okay. So I think it might be beneficial if we maybe talk to you, mostly people, maybe those that don't have a regular routine for warming up, you know, what are some main things that they should be tackling?
Yeah, so I guess first off, like, there are quite a lot of good warm-ups out there, and I think there isn't like a one size fits all with it, so just go and find some cool stuff and try it out and see how you feel. I think generally it's good just to start with something general and then just tweak it and change it depending on how you feel. I'm sure we'll kind of share some of the ways to contact me, you know, down the line, but if you come onto my Instagram or something, I've got loads of, you know, videos of players warming up and doing mobility stuff, so just nick some stuff off there. In general, like most sports, you go through a bit of a ramp process, so you try to raise your heart rate up a little bit, then you do some activation and mobilization stuff, so move through some different shapes and things like that, and then you might do some potentiation, so something explosive or heavy, so lift something or jump. So a lot of our guys, they might do 5 minutes on a bike first, or they might use the mobility work as a way of getting their heart rate up, and then they'll just go through lots of dynamic movements, you know, the kind of common stuff that most people do in a lot of sports before doing something a little bit explosive. And then actually, really importantly, they then warm up for golf using golf stuff, right? So like, that's not job done. I think sometimes the bit that's missed, actually, it's the most important part of the warm up, even if you cut the physical warm up, is probably working through the clubs and getting yourself to a position that you're ready to play. So rather than just rock up and turn up at the first tee and hit your first shot there, like, spend some time putting, chipping, pitching, working through the bag a little bit, and kind of warm up that way as well. It's really important.
Yeah, definitely. Okay. So trying things out and seeing what works for best for you there. So with regards to talking warm up and then with the getting into, you know, workout, what are some things that, you know, you see that most golfers kind of either don't that you would like for them to do to make their workout more effective or better?
Mm-hmm. I think, right, so the big thing with that question, I suppose, is that, like, getting better is very context dependent. Now, obviously, I'll get into the question in a second, but I think there aren't any kind of general one size fits all mistakes or errors that people make, because it kind of depends on what they're working towards. But I think in that, probably the biggest error that I see is people don't understand what they're working towards, or if they do understand what they're working towards, they don't understand the best way to achieve it. So you'll often have someone who just works out as a bit of a tick box. They know they need to do it, but they don't, like, really understand what they're trying to achieve by doing it at the moment. And how to measure impact and how to achieve it through effective training. And then the second thing is, if they understand what they're trying to work on, i.e. they say, I'm trying to get stronger, or I'm trying to get more stable, or whatever, they maybe don't understand exactly what that means and how the program should look to achieve that. And you'll see things like, for example, I'm trying to get stronger, and then they're doing, you know, 3 sets of 10 in their exercise. It's like, no, you should be doing like 4 or 5 sets of 3, not 3 sets of 10, or whatever it might be. So understand what you're trying to achieve. And then once you understand that, really try and understand what's the best way of achieving that, most efficient way of achieving that. So that would be one thing. I think the next thing is that people include a lot of unnecessary stuff. Like, if you, you know, great if you just want to train loads, that's fine. But like, most people train to help their sport. They don't train because training is their, you know, main love. So that means that you want it to be as minimal as possible. Like, if you can do 5 exercises instead of 10, just do 5. If you can do half an hour instead of an hour, just do half an hour. If you can train 3 times a week instead of 6 times a week, train 3 times a week. So try and just cut out all the rubbish from the program and make sure that everything has a purpose. So I think that's kind of very important. And then finally, I think the next thing is that there's a bit of a polarized debate in golf at the moment, I think, where you've got some people who are really like hyper specific on Bosu balls, doing balance work, doing loads of rotational stuff, really kind of golfy looking stuff, which is broadly accepted by the kind of strength and conditioning and research led community to be not very good. You then have the people who are trying to combat that, just saying, oh, just squat and deadlift and bench press and you'll be fine. And they're sort of pushing back so hard that they're massively oversimplifying the message, because there's way more to it than that. Otherwise, people wouldn't make a living out of it. So I think just appreciate that there's some real nuance and detail to what you need to do. And I think getting some good help is kind of an important step.
Yeah, whenever there's the two huge differences in size, it's almost always the correct answer in the middle, right? Like, yeah, you don't need to be standing on the BOSUs, and yeah, obviously squats, deadlifts, especially if you do some single leg stuff, that's going to help your balance. But I think I've seen you talk. I think we'll get into this maybe a little bit later too, but specifically about some of the balance stuff on your social media, and where is that, the right pendulum kind of swing one way versus the other way?
Yeah, and it's just, again, it's appreciating that detail, isn't it? It's like a lot of people say, oh, just squat and do 5 sets of 5, or if you're trying to do hypertrophy, do 4 sets of 8 or something. And it's like, well, it's not really quite that simple. Like, some people might need lower like reps, like 3 triples. Some people might need to be doing 5s. Rarely do you need to do 8s and things. But again, it's just the detail in picking those reps, the sets, the rest periods, like deciding whether an individual based on their body shape and size and preferences is going to have a trap bar deadlift, a normal deadlift, a sumo deadlift. They're kind of small decisions, but they're relatively important decisions. Like when we're working with Chris Wood, who's 6 foot, whatever he is, 6 foot 6 maybe, or 7, or I don't know, he's tall. If we give him back squats and deadlifts from the floor, like, it's just going to be really uncomfortable with it for him. So the nuance isn't just, oh, squat and deadlift, that'd be terrible advice for him. Like, get him to do a trap bar deadlift, or raise it up a little bit because he's quite tall, or get him to do a sumo deadlift, or get him to do a half squat. Or so just those little details around the programming, I think, matter for the individual.
Yeah, definitely. Everyone's talking about needing to individualize these programs too. So definitely fits in there. So something you said that had brought me a question and I already forgot it. But we'll go on to the next question that we had here, talking about importance of intention. We hear about being with, we'll just use Phil Mickelson here most recently at the PGA Championship. He talked about his focus and being intentional on the things that he's doing on the course, and how sometimes that can be a challenge. But we also hear that with regards to being in the gym too. So what kind of benefit does that intention give people in with regards to their squats, their jumps, their maybe med ball throws, those kinds of things?
Yeah, definitely. Good question. So I think intent, or being intentional, I think fits into sort of two categories for me. One is one that we've almost already covered, which is people sometimes aren't intentional enough about the purpose of training in the first place. Like, the best players that I work with on, the highest levels, they know exactly what they want to get out from their program, and they know why the stuff that we're putting in there is there. And that is being intentional. It's being intentional about your practice, isn't it? It's like, rather than just saying, I want to get better at golf and I'm going to go and spend 3 hours doing some random putting practice, you've actually thought, okay, this is the challenge that I have in my game at the moment. This is how I'm going to address it. So being intentional in the programming and the approach to your training, so that it gives you the outcomes that you want, is important. Probably the most important thing in training, because otherwise you're just doing a load of like stuff. And I definitely have worked with enough people who I try and change course on, where they come in and they're really bought into the gym and they train a lot, but they just do a bunch of stuff and it doesn't really help them. Even if the stuff on paper looks good, like, it's not working towards the goal that they need to achieve, and therefore it's not really helping them progress. So that's a version of intentionality, which I think is worth considering. Take it seriously, think about it deeply. The next bit is obviously the intent of the exercise, like, how much effort am I putting into that exercise? And I think that's really important, because to stress your system enough to cause the physiological adaptations that you want to get better requires you to, like, work hard enough to stress your system enough for that stuff to happen. And if you're just doing everything at like a percentage below that, like 50% effort on your jumps or something, you're just not going to get any better, because you're not going to force the adaptations. If you take lifting something heavy, for example, regardless of what, like deadlift, bench press, whatever, you don't have to max out, you don't have to go to failure all the time, so you don't have to go to like a 10 out of 10. but you have to be working somewhere between maybe like a 7 out of 10 and a 10 out of 10. So you should be working most of the time where you have like 3 reps left in the tank after you've done your 5 reps within your set, to elicit that adaptation. And it's interesting because when you work with someone who's relatively new to lifting, quite often I'll say, oh, okay, do a trap bar deadlift, let's say. And then I'll get them to score it out of 10. So a 10 is you can do 0 more reps after you finished your 5. A 9 is you could do 1 more. An 8 is you could do 2 more. A 7 is you could do 3 more, etc. And I'll say, oh, what was that? And they'll say, oh, that was a 9. And then I'll add some weight. And they'll say that was a 9. Then I'll add some more weight. They'll go, oh, that was an 8. Because now they're starting to realize that they've got more ability than they expected. And then you actually get like way beyond what they thought was a 9 or 10 by the time you're actually hitting a 9 or 10. And then they have this realization that actually I've been working like 20 or 30% lower just because I didn't believe in my ability, essentially. And experiencing what hard is allows them to like understand that when they're not maxing out, but when they're training hard, they are actually training hard. And again, you see lots of people who think they're training hard, but they're just not training hard enough. And that's why they don't get better. And then in terms of the explosive work, well, it's kind of easy for me just to put on weight and say, lift that and get to a point where you're hitting max intent, because otherwise it's not getting up. But when you jump or throw, it's kind of really difficult to gauge intent, because I can't just keep adding weight until you can't do it anymore. Like, it's about being light. And so that just takes a conscious effort to be as fast as you can and as explosive as you can. Because if you're trying to get faster, but you're not actually trying to move fast because you're like, you know, just coasting through your jumps or something, you're not going to get faster. You're not going to get more explosive. So it's really important, again, just like every throw, every jump, just switch on and put as much effort in as possible. And we use velocity monitors and things for that as well, so that we can set people targets. But for those people who don't have access to it, they just need their mindset in the right place each rep.
All right. So do you recommend then the like going by the RDP or the RIR kind of with
your protocols? So what we do is we generally don't program by percentage because it fluctuates too much. I think especially with the tour players, like, we can't test their maxes anyway because they're on the road so much, and it would be silly to be doing that at tournaments and stuff most of the time. And then because of the travel, the time zone changes and everything else that goes on, like, their relative efforts just change all the time, because sometimes they're tired, sometimes they're not, sometimes they've played 5 events in a row, and sometimes they're fresh. So we don't use percentages. We set an RPE or an RIR. So just like I described, how hard are you working out of 10, or how many reps do you have left after you finished your allocation? But then when they're with us, most of the time, very few do this without us, but we tend to strap a velocity monitor on as well, something like a push band or something like that. So we can see the effort that they're working at and their velocity drop-offs and how fast they're moving, and set them targets as well. So if it's an explosive one, we can say, you know, we want your meter per second on this jump, and the athlete can kind of try and almost compete against the number on the screen. It kind of helps drive a bit of intent, and also make sure we're programming right and their RIRs or RPEs match the numbers that we're seeing.
Yeah, so I think that feedback is critical, especially when you're talking, like you said, the speed and power stuff, because it does give you that number. It creates a game, right? Like, I recently just had a gentleman I was working with. He was coming back from a knee injury and looking to play football again, and doing some jumps, and tape measure, here we go, and like, see how far you jump the first time, okay, now beat that, okay. Yeah, like, and you know, I think he wanted to keep going after like 10 minutes, and I'm like, no, we're probably exhausted at this point.
Yeah, totally. And it's exactly the same attitude that you'd have to, like, if you wanted to max out on your swinging, like, the best thing that you can do is, if you've got access to it, if you're lucky enough to have access, get a TrackMan or something out and then swing as fast as you can, because as soon as you see that number, you want to beat it again. Whereas if you have no measure, it's just sometimes too easy to coast and not move forward.
Yeah, exactly. Awesome. So wanted to chat with you just briefly about a couple things that I saw through your posts and kind of break them down for the listeners and for my better understanding, I guess, as well. But how are you programming in your clusters into the training? So, you know, the small reps and different timings with those kinds of.
Yeah, so with certainly with more advanced athletes that I'm working with, we're using cluster sets. So for people who don't know, that might be that I set someone 5 sets of 3 reps on a back squat, but instead of doing 3 reps, they do 1, then re-rack the bar, wait for 15 to 30 seconds or something, and then do another 1, and then another 1 with those gaps in between each rep. And then they take their 4-minute break before going back to their next 3 as a cluster. Or you can do it with like 2-2-1s as well if you're trying to get a bit more volume in for something like hypertrophy or something. So the reason that I've been using that a lot is that with golf, we don't really want people doing like grindy, slow, really hard things, because we want, you know, some real quality. We want some real intent. We want a bit of speed in the lift as well. We don't want it going to a point where it's really slow a lot of the time, because there's going to be a little bit less transfer there. And so if we're trying to drive strength on, and we're trying to keep them kind of moving really well through the lift, when they're getting to those really big weights where they're quite advanced, clusters are just a really nice way of pushing that on, because again, it keeps the quality in the rep, it keeps a bit of velocity to the rep as well, but they can lift some really big numbers because they're taking those micro rests in between. So they can be really, really helpful in that regard. I don't tend to overuse them. I tend to use them like occasionally, definitely in season. I find people feel less fatigued after doing a cluster versus a relative effort on, you know, like a traditional. So if I get them doing 5 sets of 3 cluster versus 5 sets of 3 on a Wednesday before a Thursday tournament, the people who had the clusters will probably feel a little bit better, a little bit more recovered, a bit fresher, because they haven't been grindy and working to that kind of absolute fatigue. I don't overuse them, but I use them a lot in season. I use them a lot with advanced guys for those reasons. And I tend to only use them for like 1 or 2 lifts, so like the key lifts at the beginning. So they won't cluster everything, but it'll be like bench press or some overhead press or some deadlifts or some squats or something. And yeah, they've been quite effective. And to be honest, the athletes quite like them as well, because they get to like grind it, or not grind out because they're moving well, but like they get to lift a big weight and feel good. So it kind of helps them.
Okay, very interesting. And so do you base that off of, again, since we just had the discussion about the RPE, are we basing the weight more based on that aspect then?
Yeah, so I tend to, when I program, I tend to do a few things with those sorts of lifts. I'll have an RPE or RIR, and then like a description of how I want it to feel or look. And then if we're lucky enough to be, you know, able to get a velocity monitor on them, I'll include that as well. But because they don't, the description sometimes helps. So I'll say like, right, I want you an RPE 8. But then I'll say it should be smooth and not feel slow and grindy. And then I'll say, you know, like if they're with us, maybe like if it was a squat, say 0.5 meters per second or something like that. So that we're not starting to see them go down to the 0.2s or something where it's really kind of clearly slow. And then if I was with them, I might also look at velocity drop off as well, and not want to see like over 15, you know, around 15% or 20% or something would be like crazy too much, and would maybe want them nearer like a 10.
Yeah,
I mean, preferably like it would be even close to nothing with the rest, but you just wouldn't want to see it like going to a high number.
Right. Yeah. All right. So then the other one that I've seen you talk about a little bit recently is that split stance deadlift. And so with regards to, you know, why using it versus regular deadlift, or maybe like a single leg deadlift.
Yeah, no, I think it's an interesting one. So just again, for people who don't know the exercises, so the staggered stance versions I'm using. So one is that I'll get someone in a trap bar deadlift. I'll get them to stagger their stance. So one leg is slightly forward, one leg slightly back, almost like a lunge position, but much tighter than a lunge position, because there's a shorter distance between the front leg and the back leg. And it's a bit like a single leg squat or single leg deadlift, where they're pushing through the front foot more than the back foot. but the back foot's there to offer a little bit of balance and stability so that they're not, they can lift heavy and hard basically. Whereas if I asked them to do it just standing on one leg, they wouldn't have very much stability. And that's kind of relative to a single leg squat, but also relative to say a lunge, actually, where a lunge or a split squat there is, or you know, a rear foot elevated split squat as well, there's this kind of stability challenge that makes it hard to really load. So that is kind of the trap bar version. The other one that uses like a hand supported safety bar split squat, which I don't think is on the Instagram at the moment, but you have a safety bar, which is a bar that kind of wraps around your neck a little bit over your shoulders. And that means that you can take your hands off and you can hold on to something while you split squat. The other option that I use sometimes is a staggered stance Romanian deadlift, which is a Romanian deadlift, like a single leg Romanian deadlift, which people have probably done before, except again, that rear foot is just touching the floor for a bit of balance so that you can load it up more. And the reason I do that is if I'm after kind of a unilateral, you know, single leg type exercise, balance is a kind of isn't a general quality, it's quite a specific quality. So not only is there not a massive balance challenge in golf because you are on a stable surface all the time, even when you're in sand it's pretty stable and you screw your feet in, and you know, but even if you weren't on a stable surface, even if you're a gymnast having to do a handstand, like the qualities of balance are such that it's essentially a skill. And if you're looking for transfer to sports performance, the best way to develop your balance for the sport is by doing the sports. The best way for a gymnast to learn to handstand is to do handstands, not to do some overhead control exercise in the gym. The slight caveat to that, of course, is if you're rehabbing someone, sometimes there's relevance to doing balance training, but that's kind of a different topic outside of the performance realm. So with that in mind, with balance being a general and not specific kind of quality, or specific, not general quality, and not something we can really develop in the gym for golf, I figure like I'm much more interested in just developing strength through one limb than I am having the stability challenge. And by getting people to stagger stance and have the rear foot down in their RDLs or in their deadlifts or using the hand support for their split squats, it takes away the balance challenge completely of being on one leg, which means that you can just really drive the weight, or you can drive the kind of explosive strength qualities depending on the exercise. Because we also do like a staggered stance trap bar jump as well, if we want them to be explosive strength focused on one leg. And it's just a way of working one leg for the athletic quality you're after without the constraint of like, oh, I'm struggling to balance. So it works quite nicely.
So mostly just kind of focusing on that, the pure strength of that single leg rather than the balance with the strength component with most of the single leg activities is the main reason.
Yeah, 100%. We're basically trying to rip out any balance challenge by saying, right, with the safety bar, you can hold on, or you can stagger your stance. And I think that's true of, say, like the RDL. Loads of people do single leg RDLs in golf. And it's like, it's such a diluted exercise because the balance is so difficult for a single leg Romanian deadlift that you can't load it heavy. So then if you can't load it heavy, like what physiological adaptation is it driving other than balance? And more balance is specific, not general, so it doesn't transfer. So it kind of becomes a bit pointless. Whereas as soon as you put the rear leg down, the balance challenge is gone and you can now make it quite heavy and you can get really kind of strong through, you know, in a unilateral sort of one-legged exercise, relatively one leg. Obviously the back leg does something. But
awesome. All right, so that was the last little bit of questions that we had there, and go through a quick and rapid round. I call it the mulligan round. Basically, you get to skip one question if you want. If it comes down to nothing too crazy. Sometimes I throw in a crazy one, but nothing for you today. So what would be the superhero power that you would want?
Oh God, I don't know. Maybe flying, that'd be quite cool. Especially if it was fast, because then I wouldn't need to get planes at the moment and I could skip all the COVID rubbish.
Great. What's your go-to karaoke song?
Don't Stop Me Now, definitely.
Awesome, good one. What's the weirdest golf term you've heard, especially as a non-golfer?
Do you know what? I think mulligan, actually. Like, yeah, it's weird. It's a strange, strange word. When I first came across that, I was like, how did that even like originate?
Yeah, I actually don't know. I'll have to do some research on that one, figure out why. What's the favorite exercise or drill for your personal life?
for my personal life, time out on the bike, I'd say, like going out for a bike ride, favorite exercise.
All right. What's a takeaway you want people to have from today's conversation?
Probably the take home is just that, well, that's a really good question, actually. I'm not quite sure what take home is. I think hopefully it's just kind of opening your eyes to some of the, I'm sure people interested in this will already be aware because they're trying to educate themselves about the topic, but just some of the nuance and complexity around some of the decisions that we make. It's not as simple as squat, hinge, push, pull. Although we use a lot of that stuff, there's kind of a bit of detail to how we decide to prescribe it and how we pick the right exercises and how we test and make those decisions. And hopefully that's interesting because, you know, it's the sort of stuff that you do with the elite end that I think transfers to everybody.
Yeah, definitely. All right, so this one is, if you had a professional and they could either hit the tee ball for you or the putt for you, which one would you take? You've played a little bit of golf, I know, so... Which one?
Yeah, so I'd take the putt because, like, I always used to play snooker, and there's something like when I was young, so my dad was well into it. So there's something quite satisfying, I think, about the putting and like actually getting the ball in the hole. So they can do the rest, and I'll take the putt.
All right, sounds good. Well, Dan, thank you so much for coming on. Before you go, let's see what can people get into finding more about you and what you're doing.
Yeah, so if people want to get in touch, you're welcome. But come and have a look at my Instagram page, which is just at Dr. Dan Coughlan. My Twitter is the same, Dr. Dan Coughlan. And then I've got a website as well, which is just dancoughlan.com. So you can come and have a look and send me a DM if you want.
All right. Well, that's it for this episode of the Golf Under Par podcast. We'll have the information that Dan just shared in the show notes. So check it out there and learn more from him on his stuff. And thank you so much for listening. And Dan, thank you for coming on.
Yeah, no worries. Thanks for having me.
Thank you guys for listening to this episode. Hopefully you've enjoyed this content on the go. If you found it helpful, please share with a friend and leave us a review on iTunes. This allows us to reach more golfers just like you that want to play under par. Do you want to be stronger and healthier? Well, I've got a resource for you, Golf Fitness Tips. It's a free Facebook group where we talk about how to take care of our bodies so that we can play more golf, we can play golf longer in life, and we can play better on the course. If that interests you, then check out the link below or search for Golf Fitness Tips on Facebook.